Welcome back, WNST, Towson, Baltimore, and Baltimore. Positive and nothing more positive than today. Today's going to be a good one. We're at Jennings Cafe. We are celebrating the beginning of football season. We're celebrating the beginning of fall. And we're celebrating finally getting the big fish, the big guest that we've been...
No pressure on our guest today whatsoever.
Sarah Heminger is here from Thread. And I would not have known about you had it not been for Baltimore Positive, because I'm not swimming in that circle and being the sports guy. Every single person, beginning with Dutch Ruppersberger, I think you can go back and watch the videos. There may have been somebody that did not reference you, or that by the time five in a row referenced you, Don started referencing you, right? Like, Don's like, oh, we've heard about Sarah.
We've heard about Sarah.
So then I just assume that he knew you. And then about episode 10, I'm like, yeah, we're going to get Sarah on. Don knows Sarah. Don's like, I don't know her. I only read about her. And I'm like, so how are we going to get her on? And here you are. So thank you for gracing us with your tale, because I don't know the full extent of the story. I only know the legend. And I'm a little like Larry King. I don't read the book before I bring the guest on. So I'm going to learn a lot today. So welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Biomedical engineer.
Yes.
So I guess the question, Sarah, is we start at the, and Esther was absolutely clear, and I think it's where we need to begin, is to assume that folks listening know nothing about Thread. Mm-hmm. They care about Baltimore, they believe in Baltimore, but they don't know anything about Thread. So can you take us back to the beginning of what Thread is and how it became a part of your life? I mean, where did you, I mean, I think I have a sense from what I've read about you, where you got the idea, but walk us through about the beginning of Thread.
Sure. So, you know, we really are comprised of, like, our DNA comes from two stories. One is the story of kind of my childhood and upbringing, and the second of my close friends. So I grew up in Indiana, in Indianapolis, and during my...
Colts fan?
Yes.
It ends things right there. Yeah.
Although I will say that this is how we know our daughter is a true Baltimorean, is that she is a Ravens fan through and through, wants to wear purple all the time. Purple's my favorite color, so...
Purple's behind you. You look nice with a purple backdrop. Yes. So
we're back in Indiana.
She's working on us. It's the one remnant of Indiana that actually did stick.
So take us back to Indiana.
Well, if the Colts sent us Thread back, maybe there's... Right? Maybe this is a fair swap, right?
It's a good thing.
Maybe. Go ahead, Indianapolis.
Go ahead.
So, you know, grew up there. My first day of high school, I walk into class. I get in an argument with another student about where we were allowed to sit. And that argument turned into a lot of other arguments about politics and religion. And for me, that developed into a crush. So he happened to be a senior. I was a freshman. Turns out he was right about where we were supposed to be sitting. That's one of the few things he's been right about. Let's just keep the score very clear. But no, in all seriousness, over time, as we became friends, people would say things about him like his mom is a drug addict and drug dealer. And where I grew up, this wasn't your normal everyday gossip. And so when you're 14 years old and you have a crush on a boy, the last thing you want to do is walk up to him and be like, so, is your mom dealing drugs? Like, you know, how do you even broach that conversation?
An icebreaker.
Yeah. Like, where's the icebreaker for that? And so eventually he, typed out for me on, you know, I don't know if you remember those Apple II computers. They were the first,
sure.
This 8-page letter that described what had happened. His mom had been in a car accident. A week later in a second car accident, the injuries were so severe that she couldn't walk. So that meant she couldn't work. So she ended up losing their job. They ended up losing their home. They had been living in suburban Indianapolis. And so what ended up happening is they moved into the city, into public housing. She became depressed and addicted to Dilaudid. And then as that spiraled out of control, she began to sell drugs in order to support her own habit. So in terms of from where he was coming from, he went from what was the equivalent of cornfields and 18 months later was essentially living in the equivalent of a crack house. And that coincided with his transition into high school. So he ended up missing more than 30 days of school, failing his classes, and was planning to drop out. And there was a group of teachers that basically looked at him, and instead of being like, don't be so lazy, you can do better, you should be coming to school, you know, like, what's wrong with you? They said, okay, here is a young person whose basic human needs are not being met. So they would drive to his house. They would give him a ride to school. They would bring him breakfast. They would help him with his homework. They would do things that a neighbor might do or your family might do. And so, you know, it's a lot easier to, you have to choose to go to school. No one can force you to go to school. But it is a lot easier to choose to go to school if you've eaten, if you have a ride instead of taking three buses that takes 2 hours, right? And if you have clean clothes, you know, just the simple act of making sure he had laundry, high school can be so brutal, but if you smell bad, you know,
it's worse.
Yeah, it's worse. It's like, these are the things that unless you've been in that situation, you don't really think about and you can take for granted. And so their support and their love, really changed his life. He ended up, by the time I met him when he was a senior, was a straight A student, varsity athlete, getting ready to go to the Naval Academy. And so I joke my first strategic planning process was to convince him to date and marry me, which I succeeded at.
And this is your husband, Ryan, that we're talking about, who was this ninth grader and now senior who's at the Naval Academy.
Correct. And so, you know, that is one kind of part of the DNA of Thread, which is this deep understanding that young people in Baltimore City are not broken. There is nothing wrong with them, but oftentimes there are things outside of their control that can really be distracting from focusing on your academic life or your civic life or just your own, like, growing up. Like, it's hard to grow up.
And it's hard to see that from the suburbs, I think, you know? I mean, I grew up in Dundalk 30 years ago. You know, I guess in the middle of it, I saw some situations. Don was my high school guidance counselor. I actually said something to Don earlier. I said, you must have really seen some stuff, you know, that 30 years later. And, you know, Dundalk has its challenges. You know, you're familiar with that. The city was a place in Dundalk my parents wouldn't have sent me. And that's 35 years ago to say that it wouldn't have been good. To be in that environment every day and to try to make a difference. I mean, I had breakfast with someone today that was at one point a civic leader that just said, it's not worth trying anymore. I mean, I heard somebody
say, and that's
say,
what we're pushing
literally,
back.
Literally. I had a coffee this morning with someone said, it's a lost cause. I've given up on it. I'm like, no. I live at the harbor. I'm not giving up. And then I get inspired by seeing people like you that aren't giving up and having the city literally. Is that the city around your neck?
Yeah.
Well, I can see my house there, right in the harbor, right in the middle. I mean, you have fallen in love with Baltimore. That's difficult for someone from Indianapolis to do. I've tried with a lot of Colts fans.
No, I've fallen in love with the people. I mean, and I think this connects to the second part of our DNA, which is my childhood was super traumatic. So, you know,
So you saw that in a way that some people can't see the trauma or understand anything other than they don't test well.
Well,
literally.
Talk about your childhood. When you say folks are sitting out there and they hear this biomedical engineer from Hopkins say, my childhood was traumatic, thus part of who I am. What does that mean?
I mean, there's the obvious things. Mm-hmm. So I was born with a facial deformity, teased a lot as a kid. At the age of 8, I was actually kidnapped from my home and lucky enough to make it back alive. But the more consequential thing that happened was around that same time. I grew up in a very religious family, and my father found out that the pastor of the church was misusing money. And so when my family revealed that, instead of firing the pastor, they decided that they would instead shun our family. And so you'd say, well, why did my parents not just leave? But they felt very strongly that there were a number, you know, there are hundreds of people in that church being taken advantage of. And so we did eventually leave 8 years later, and everyone left with us. So that was community organizing one-on-one.
Right,
you know, my 10,000 hours was there, and learned a lot of really key skills and lessons. But what also happened is I would go to church 3 days a week and have no one speak to me. The children couldn't speak to me. The adults wouldn't speak to me. My own cousins, aunts and uncles, like we would have gatherings at my grandparents where I was with my siblings segregated into different rooms from my cousins because of this situation.
How old are you at that time, Sarah?
It's from the time I was 8 to the time I was 16.
Okay. Well, I would think that would greatly affect your religious conviction at that point to say in a house of worship we're not... Love is not being exchanged, right? That's the point of being there, right? At church.
You know, it did something quite different. Because my family was so tight-knit in that moment, and I watched my parents have such deep faith and deep comfort with the concept of long-suffering. So there was a stamina and a willingness to stick in something that was modeled for me that is still in me now.
Never quit.
Yeah, you never quit. And it's not about the outcome. It's about how you're showing up in the situation. So it wasn't for them to get to a particular place to like show this guy up. It really was, are they being faithful to the thing that they feel called to do in the moment? And so that's what I was raised understanding as success. It was never about, do you attain this or achieve that? It was, who are you when stuff is really, really hard? And how do you, you know, my family, I feel like brilliantly built this tight-knit relationships within like our little unit.
That was strong enough.
So strong. And like had certain characteristics that are also in the DNA of Thread. For example, my parents from the time I was 5 years old invited me and my siblings to participate in decisions like what house we would buy, you know, what car, what the finances look like. So from a very young age, I was given agency and a voice.
You were a stakeholder.
Yeah. And then taught how to make decisions and feel confident in making decisions, making mistakes, and like, you know, so there was a lot packed into that that I think was really helpful that, if anything, increased my faith. It didn't, but what it did do is like give me this deep sense of what it feels to be unwanted and to be rejected and to actually be treated as less than human. And I think the thing to kind of extrapolate from that is that for me, those traumas had a beginning and an end, right? And so I was able to work through it. For our young people in Baltimore,
they don't see the end, right?
It's ongoing.
Right.
It is every day, 24/7, ongoing. There is no end to it. And it is in every little and big thing. Like the fact that 84% of the schools don't have drinking water that, you know, that messages to someone like you're not worth drinking water. Like water is necessary for a human being to survive. And yet we don't think you're important enough or matter enough that you get water.
I bring up water like, a lot on this show.
You know, Nestor's a fan of water. Well, yeah, it's interesting, Sarah, when you mention that, because there's so much discussion right now about the quality of school buildings and the message that that sends to thousands, I guess there are roughly 80,000 students.
Sending children to a place
in the Baltimore
that
City
no
public
one
schools.
Would want to go physically in an environment no one would choose to go. And then saying to your point, in order to be there, you have to choose to be there, right? Like in the end, if you're going to be there 12 grades, and you have to choose to be there. And it has to be hospitable, right? Human, right?
Yeah.
Running water.
And not just those spaces, but it's like, what are the other spaces in the city? If you think about some of the beautiful spaces like Harbor East or the Inner Harbor, and if you ask yourself, like, what signals are we sending to young people as to whether that space is actually theirs?
Right.
Like,
I live in the Inner Harbor.
Right. So whose space is the Inner Harbor? Is it everyone in Baltimore's space, or is that space meant only for certain people? And how do we subtly and directly and very explicitly send signals about who's welcome and who's not?
Well, I think that's been a really interesting part of the discussion about the future of Harbor Place. And I think none of us know exactly where Harbor Place will land, but yeah, folks like you and others are saying that whatever we do at Harbor Place, it has to be ours. It has to belong to the city. It has to belong to the residents. It has to belong to the young people, as well as to the tourists, and as well as to the people from the suburbs who want to come
well,
down.
I'm as
it has to feel like ours.
I own my condos at the Inner Harbor. I overlook it all day, every day. It is my backyard. It is where I walk through. It needs to be a place people want to come. When I say to you, hey, I live downtown. You want to come down and have a drink tonight? Sure. I wouldn't want to be anywhere else other than when it becomes that again, and it's been that for most of my lifetime. I'm 50. The harbor is the place I wanted to be. It's the place I invested my life. Yeah. It's the place I've chosen to live for the last two decades. But when I say it now, it has a different connotation. And that's something that's post-Freddie Gray. That's something that's post-Wire. That's something that, for me and other people, is post-Orioles, because that's what I've done. That was a thing that brought 3.6 million people, 45,000 a night, every night, downtown, where it did feel like everyone came. It was a beacon of light. Now it does feel like something that those who aren't vested want to run from or hold their nose or say, that's a place I'm never going to go. We're trying to make it a place that everyone will want to go, because for it to be successful, that's what it needs to be. It needs to be a place everyone yes. wants to go and use.
Exactly. I think that is going to require not just structural change, but it's going to require a complete framework shift, though, of how we view people. So I think, generally speaking, in this country, we have a narrative of there's a group of haves and a group of have-nots. There's a group of people that are going to fix things and people that need to be fixed. people that are, you know, and so that narrative creates a situation that I think, until we start to change the mindset, we're never going to get traction. I'm a scientist by training, and so I'm like a total nerd, and like I go to the data. Like the data is like crystal clear about these things. So relationships are the thing that individuals need to be healthy. There's tons of studies on this. The oldest one looked at young men going from their late teens and early 20s into their 70s, 80s, and 90s.
Is that that Harvard study?
Yes.
That you referenced?
Yes, yes. And I mean, the phenomenal thing is they thought going in that the thing that would predict whether or not someone had like dementia, heart disease, cancer was going to be their race or their educational attainment or their parents' educational attainment. And it turned out it was very simple. Like, did they consistently throughout their life have three or more relationships where when they really needed somebody, they knew they had someone that they could call? Those men actually had less heart disease, less dementia, right. less cancer, right? So relationships are something that we all, it's like water. We need it to exist.
Isolation is disease.
Isolation is disease. And so the challenge becomes, like, we all need it, but that requires, you know, there's kind of two aspects of it. Those who have been told they're a have-not their whole life and that they're disadvantaged and this, that, and the other won't even go through all the negative words that are used to describe our young people often.
I would call them away values, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Things we want to move away from.
Yeah. They, like, them understanding that they can fundamentally change your life, my life, by being in relationship with us, that they have something so deep to give in their ability to listen and see and understand and love us, reinforces for them a sense of identity and
value.
Worth.
Yeah,
yeah,
value.
It's worth.
Sure,
it,
yeah.
It, right? Like, so it's a way of telling someone you matter that goes deeper than the water. The water does matter too. We need that. But what we really need is for people to actually believe that our young people not just matter, but that we need them. It's a step beyond matter. It's without you, I am worse off. And that is the thing that then if you go to the data and the collective like space and look at cities that are healthy, the cities that have the most cross-connectedness across lines of difference are the ones who have better education, less crime, better public health. And they have the same similar demographics to Baltimore City. Many of them have been towns that lost industries similar to Baltimore City. So
give us a success story. I'm interrupting. Give
sorry.
Us a city that's doing that well.
I mean, to varying degrees, but I think Youngstown, Allentown is always an example that has been used that comparison because they were so similar. Sean Stafford, also from Harvard, mm-hmm. went in and looked at, you know, demographically, why were they so similar? And yet their outcomes in those buckets of education, public health, crime were so different. And it really did come down to, like, in Allentown, you know, the diversity of, like, we would bowl together and, you know, with them, I'd go to church and we would work at the factory together. So the diversity of the cross-connectedness versus the simple answer would be in Youngstown where things weren't working, we would bowl, go to church, and go to the factory. So that lack of diversity in the social
capital.
We were
in silos.
Silos.
In one and not in
the other. Oh, I think Facebook is really an amazing part of that because of all my life in 50 years that I see people say and write things, you know, as the President of the United States is unfortunately visiting us today, that I just can't fathom that they could have a circle. They don't know that I'm not part of their circle, you know, or that circle or whatever that is, that it becomes easier to speak freely like that, I think, in the modern era. And you see how small a circle can be based on, and I say to Don all the time, if you show me your passport, I'll know you've traveled. And if I know you've traveled, it changes that perspective from only being, and I'll say this as a Dundalk, only being from Dundalk, only spending time in Dundalk, never leaving Dundalk. I grew up with a lot of people that, unfortunately, Ocean City was a long way. Towson was someplace they would only go once a year, literally, maybe do a baseball game once a year and home. And I do think that I've seen that over the course of my lifetime. I can't imagine in a place where you have no ability to even find a supermarket, let alone transportation to get from your neighborhood to the next neighborhood.
Yeah.
The challenge is, what could the worldview be and how can you bring that to West Baltimore, East Baltimore, as you've tried to do?
Yeah. And that same, just to be clear, like that same isolation though exists in Roland Park and Guilford. And part of that is technology, as you're mentioning. Part of it is just the individualistic culture that is pervasive throughout this country. And part of it is as you gain financial wealth, you actually need people less for simple things. So there's like this old story about this group of women who used to like get together to do the laundry at the laundromat. And then they all somehow got washing machines and then depression went way up in that community.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And so sometimes these matters of convenience actually really serve to dismantle a sense of community, because when you actually lack financial resources, it forces you to have stronger social ties because you actually need one another in a more basic sense. So it was interesting. Yesterday, I was talking to a young person, and he was asked by someone, what do you love about Baltimore City? And they had all given answers about like how divided everything was and how, you know, and he was like, I love the community unity here. And they all looked at him like he had four heads. And he's like, yeah, my community is very tight. We have very good relationships. We can really count on one another. And they literally,
where is that? Right.
Yeah. He lives in Sandtown, Winchester. Right.
The good news is he felt connected, right?
Yeah, and so that's the point, is like this isolation is impacting everyone, and it's not just impacting people living in poverty. And systems of oppression disproportionately impact historically, you know, people of color, and I think race is always the trump card, but you know, it is impacting everyone. This is seen in the opioid epidemic, right? Like we're seeing this in the incidence of suicide and addiction. I find it just like jarring that my demographic, women between the ages of 30 and 55, we will be the first, in this country's history group of, like within a demographic where we will not outlive our mothers. And the two leading causes of death are suicide and overdose.
Wow.
So you have to ask yourself, what is happening to all the middle-aged white women? Right. You know, and I think it's like they have their own washing machine, right? That's a part of it.
And they feel like they're not meeting out to hang the laundry on the the line in the old days and not having that discussion in the laundromat. It's wow, amazing.
So there's something this is a problem that I think, Baltimore historically has been a place where, like, how did we get here? Part of it is technology. Part of it is just a global economy. But part of it is that we have intentionally segregated people with policies and practices. I mean, think about Baltimore being the home of redlining. Like, we didn't get here accidentally.
That's not something to be proud of. Right. Yeah.
No, but it's something to own. Like,
something to overcome.
Yes, but that's the opportunity. So I think where part of the opportunity lies is we are very siloed. But within those silos, we have immense strength. So within our neighborhoods in Baltimore, there are strong communities. There is this deep connection. And if you can bridge the silos, I think we as a city are positioned to solve the problem that no other city I know of has solved, which is how do we actually address social isolation in a way where you knit together a social fabric that is truly diverse, and then that social fabric has a culture that is representative of all of the individuals in it. Like, that, I think, is the vision for our city and something where we can be the first to demonstrate that, one, it's possible, and then, like, here's how you do it. And that, if we can do that, that will then impact education and crime and all of those things. But that's the place we're trying to head.
Real quick, before we take a break, because
You're going into the next segment?
No, I'm not. I'm not going into the next segment, but I can hear our listeners right now saying, guys, Sarah mentioned, and if you don't want to talk about this, it's fine, but I can hear our listeners saying, guys, Sarah told you in the first 3 or 4 minutes of the interview that she was kidnapped as a young child, and you all sort of went on. Is that something do you talk about that experience or what happened there? Because when you said that, it sort of went by me. I thought, Sarah was kidnapped, you know, and
that'll
you were, what,
it.
8 years old?
Eight, yeah. I mean, sure, I talk about it. I mean, I talk about it openly with the people in my life. And I think, you know, for me, the reason to even mention it is if you look at me on paper or I just walk in a room, there's a set of assumptions that get made because we all have certain biases. And what I'm trying to do is I have so much privilege. My life is like layered in layers and layers of privilege. And part of what privilege gives you is the right to privacy. So I can choose to disclose that or not, right? And so part of what I'm trying to do is give, like, part of utilizing the privilege that I have been born into is giving up some of that privacy and trying to get people to pause next time they meet somebody and think about what bias they might be bringing, positive or negative, right? About who you think I might be. I'm guessing when I walked in the door, that wasn't what you jumped to.
No, I'm thinking biomedical engineer, some girl that grew up, had everything that she needed to be an outstanding student, and of course she ended up being a biomedical engineer.
No, so you know how I ended up being, I mean, no. My dad started cleaning floors in a plumbing store, became a plumber. My mom stayed at home with children. My parents could have cared less about education in the formal sense. Again, they cared about, like, being faithful to the task you're doing. How did I get here? It was part of the strategic plan to marry Ryan. So he went to the Naval Academy. He's like, I'm not going to marry somebody without a college degree. I'm like, well, I better get one of those.
I need that.
I had never even heard of Johns Hopkins. I literally found it in a College Board book organized by state. I was like, oh, the state of Maryland. I'm not even sure I really knew
close
where Maryland
enough to
was.
Annapolis.
Yeah, I was like, that
looks like, how much is tuition?
No, I was like, you know, okay, so we'll figure this out. And then, like, I was walking around campus with Ryan on a visit, and I was like, I think I might come here. And he's like, okay. I was like, what should I major in? He's an electrical engineer, and because I didn't even know what college majors were,
right?
Like, that's where I was. You got to understand where I was starting. Right. And he was like, well, as long as you don't major in engineering, I'm sure you can graduate on time. And I was like,
that was a challenge.
Okay,
I can see it in your eyes.
So I walked around campus and I was like, tell me what the hardest engineering major is here. And everyone's like, BME. I'm like, what the hell? I don't think I knew what biomedical engineering really was until I was in grad school. Like, honestly, like, it's a complicated field.
How do you describe it to someone? What's your napkin speech on what a biomedical engineer is?
Yeah, what were you supposed to do?
I mean, what do they do? Tell our listeners.
What were you going to do with that?
Wait.
Well,
what were you going to do with biomedical engineering?
Going to academia. So I worked with patients who had degenerative disorders of the cerebellum, primary motor cortex, and then I basically was a computational scientist. So I would build mathematical models to try to understand when that part of your brain is impacted by loss of neurons, what does that tell us about how the brain is connected and how it's wired? And so for me, it really maps to like a city. To me, the brain and a city are the same, which is you cannot walk unless two conditions are met. You cannot walk unless the individual portions of your brain are healthy and the connections between them are healthy. And the city, I think, is the same thing. In order for a city to be healthy, you have to have the individual components be healthy and the cross-connectedness between them be healthy. So I think the overall like systems thinking that I learned in science very much applies now. But I was supposed to be a faculty member now. That was the job I turned down when I decided to do this in a more in-depth way.
And now, HEAD's one of the most successful mentoring programs in the entire world.
I'm going to refer Jennings Burger right now.
You think we smart people? Is that what we said every week?
I want to sit back, have iced tea at Jennings Burger, and let you. We said we were going to do this in the beginning, like narrative wise, and I'm lost already.
Smart people.
We're going to go backwards.
We thank our sponsors, Jennings and State Fair up the street, Fadley's in the city. We're with Sarah Heminger. People told us we had to have her on. I think we now know why. Can't wait for segment two.
Stuart Berger coming up in our next set of episodes, as well as next week. We're back at Fadley's with Baltimore City Council President Brandon Scott. We've got Sarah Heminger here. It's as good as advertised. Thanks for coming. We appreciate you.
We'll be back.
We got more stories to tell. We are Baltimore Positive at WNST.net, AM 1570, and WNST Towson, Baltimore. And we never stop talking Baltimore Positive.